This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. That was the scene this morning outside the Michigan State House in Lansing as activists protested the legislature's work on two bills to rewrite the state's labor laws and make Michigan the 24th state in the country to become a right-to-work state. Rick Pluta, the managing editor and State House bureau chief for Michigan Public Radio Network, joins us now by phone from the State House. Nice to have you on the program today.
Long-time listener, first-time caller. It's my pleasure.
What's the latest, Rick?
State House just voted to send both of the bills to Governor Rick Snyder, who, after 2 years of saying this is really something he'd like not to see land on his desk, that the issue is just too divisive, said that he will sign them. And in one sense, what he said about it being divisive, it seems to be prophetic, at least in terms of today. We've got 10,000, 12,000 protesters inside, outside the state capitol. There are reports that at this moment it's getting a lot messier out there, that people are very angry. We've got state police and local police departments from many parts of Michigan here, many of them in riot gear, some of them on horseback trying to push back the protesters after this vote.
And was this vote strictly along party lines?
There were a few Republicans, very few Republicans, who defected from their party, but all the Democrats voted against it. That this is just seen as, you know, literally an attack on unions and on the political authority here in Michigan of the Democratic Party.
And all of this blew up since Election Day.
That unions, after suffering through a couple of years of what they saw as a series of anti-labor legislation in our Republican dominant legislature, and we have a Republican governor who used to be a business person, felt like they wanted to do something. And so what they came up with was Proposal 2, a ballot question that would enshrine collective bargaining rights in the state constitution. Excuse me. But it also did a whole lot more. It would have rolled back 170 laws. Some of them dealt with things like the safety of school children. And so there was a very effective campaign mounted against that, and the proposal went down in defeat. And for some supporters of right to work in Michigan, they thought that that was their opening to get it done.
I was just going to say, in particular, because the next legislature, the one that was elected on November 6th, may not be as positive towards
not be. That right now that Republicans have very substantial majorities in the House and the Senate. They will still have majorities next year, but in the state House, there will be five fewer Republicans. Because they kind of took a thumping here on Election Day, not to mention because Michigan is a term limit state, that there are a few Republicans who are on their way out the door who can cast these votes without really worrying about what it means for their political future. So this was really the right to work supporters really saw this as their window.
And there is also another bill in Wisconsin. People will remember recall elections were staged against legislators who voted for anti-union bills. The Michigan legislators thought about that.
And as a matter of fact, unions say that one of the things they're going to do is they're going to target some legislators, at least those who are in vulnerable districts or sort of middle of the road districts. They say some of them may be targeted for recall. There's also talk of trying to recall Governor Rick Snyder, although I should point out that Michigan's laws for recalling statewide officials raise the bar a little bit higher than what exists in Wisconsin, where, you know, unions and Democrats tried to recall Governor Scott Walker.
In the meantime, this seems set to be issue A in Michigan for the foreseeable future.
This certainly seems to have catapulted to the top of the pile in terms of political issues, yes.
And some people say if this can happen in Michigan, the home of the United Auto Workers Union, the most unionized state in the union, it can happen anywhere.
Yeah, the the cradle of the labor movement. As a matter of fact, we're coming up on December 30th, the 76th anniversary of the Flint sit-down strike that really launched the United Auto Workers as a bargaining power. And some of the Democrats who voted against this today in the legislature had grandparents, great grandparents who were sit-down strikers who are sort of revered here in Michigan in many quarters.
It should be pointed out there's a couple of exemptions. Existing contracts, as I understand it, will not be affected.
It is unconstitutional to abrogate an existing contract. And so, for example, the Ford contract runs, I think, until September of 2015. So, right to work won't be affecting that company until then. And there are also exemptions for police unions and firefighter unions. And that conceivably could be the subject of a legal challenge that unions are looking at going to court and filing an equal protection lawsuit against this law based on that.
We will stay tuned. Rick Bluta, we'll let you get back to work.
Okay, thanks.
Rick Bluta from the Michigan State House in Lansing. He's the bureau chief for Michigan Public Radio Network. Though Michigan would be the 24th state to pass right-to-work legislation, only three states have done so in recent memory: Indiana, Oklahoma, and Idaho. So we'd like to hear from listeners in those states. What difference does it make? If you live in Indiana, Oklahoma, Idaho, we want to hear from you. After right-to-work legislation passed, what changed in your life? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Gary Dick is creator and host of Inside Indiana Business with Gary Dick, which airs on many platforms in the state, both commercial and public. And he joins us now from member station WFYI in Indianapolis. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
And what difference has the right-to-work legislation that passed Indiana, 10 months ago, made there?
Yeah, it really is. I think it's fair to say that it's too soon to really tell a difference, Neil, on any impact. Certainly organized labor has contended, as they are in Michigan, that right to work will mean lower wages, lower benefits, a decrease in safety, those types of things. If, in fact, those things are to happen, it would take time for that to play out. I will say that economic developers around the state are talking about an increased number of calls from companies who say, with right to work now in the books here in Indiana, that that has opened up the state to be in the running for economic development investment. So we'll see how that plays out. Economic developers have always said, look, this will give your state more at-bats, if you will, to compete for economic development projects. Those thoughtful people who really think about this issue and those who are in the business know that right to work is not the issue typically that a company would choose to locate in a particular state, but one of several factors that could potentially come into play.
Sure, transportation for their particular product and the cost of living for their workers.
Yep, absolutely. It's a whole host of things. If you're in a state that isn't very competitive with infrastructure and those types of things, probably not going to get a good look anyway. But in those states that are competitive, and I think you can put Indiana certainly in that that ballpark, right to work, in terms of supporters, they say right to work gives Indiana a leg up on some projects.
President Obama said yesterday outside of Detroit in advance of today's vote in Lansing, he said that he doesn't see these laws as being about economics at all, but rather about politics. I wonder how that's playing out in Indiana.
It was certainly a very, very volatile political issue. And I heard the previous report from Michigan talking about the governor there not wanting to pursue this because it is such a divisive issue. Interesting that Governor Mitch Daniels, who will soon be ending his second term and leaving to become the president of Purdue University, he basically had the same commentary for the last several sessions saying, hey, he did not want this to happen because he knew how volatile, how very contentious the issue certainly is. And that was the case this year at the Indiana State House. Very similar scenes to what you're seeing in Michigan, what you saw in Wisconsin. I know that was a different deal with public sector unions, but thousands and thousands of union workers and supporters rallying and converging on the State House here in Indiana. And in fact, from a political standpoint, it even prompted House Democrats here to walk out. They walked out, drove across the state lines to Illinois, and really for several weeks held the legislature, for the most part, pretty much at a standstill.
Has there been any impact, since in the election that has occurred since then?
Yeah, actually, the Republican majorities in Indiana have actually strengthened, and now there is a so-called supermajority in both the House and the Senate here in the Indiana legislature, and Governor Mitch Daniels will be leaving a Republican. The governor-elect Mike Pence is also a Republican. So actually, in terms of the majority, Republicans feel, I think, perhaps a bit emboldened because their majorities have actually increased in this last election.
And as you say, it's too early to gauge the effect on wages or working conditions, for that matter. It's a little too early to gauge whether new businesses will actually move to Indiana. But what about union membership? Has that been measured?
Well, that's not specifically in Indiana, but I think anecdotally and generally you can talk about the decrease in union membership in states like Indiana. Just a function in large part of traditional American manufacturing going away. A community like Anderson, Indiana, which at one time had some 25,000 General Motors workers. Today they have zero. And you look at other auto industry towns around the state that have shrunk in size. That alone has made for a reduction in union membership. And that's why one of the reasons, I think, why this is such a very volatile issue, because organized labor looks at this and looks at a state in the Midwest, in the Rust Belt, the so-called Rust Belt of Indiana, becoming right to work. Now with Michigan, with that possibility, they see that as a real threat to their ultimate survival.
And you mentioned the political controversy in Wisconsin. Again, that was over public sector employees. There was similar controversies in Ohio as well. It does look like this issue is not going away anytime soon in that part of the country.
Yeah, no question about it. And it still remains a very, very contentious issue. And as you look at politically here in this state, one of the things it did, it really the acrimony between parties, which, you know, the parties always have their rivalries, but it really exacerbated that situation. I think it remains today. But we shall see in terms of that ultimate impact here in the state of Indiana. We'll see as it plays out.
Gary Dick, thanks very much.
Thank you, Neil.
Gary Dick, creator and host of Inside Indiana Business with Gary Dick. He joined us today from member station WFYI in Indianapolis. So if you're in one of those states that's gone right to work in more recent memory, Idaho, Oklahoma, and Indiana, we want to hear from you. If you're listening in Muncie, Boise, or Norman, what changed to your life after right-to-work legislation passed? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. Earlier this afternoon, the Michigan legislature approved two measures that would make the state the country's 24th right-to-work state. Governor Rick Snyder says he'll sign the plan into law, perhaps as early as tomorrow. Indiana also became a right-to-work state earlier this year. Oklahoma and Idaho are the only other two states to have done so in recent memory. Most of the other states with this sort of legislation passed it in the 1940s. Today, we're interested in hearing from states where it's been a recent change. Oklahoma, Idaho, Indiana. If you live in one of those states, how did your life change after right-to-work legislation passed? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Though the laws vary slightly, 23 states make it illegal for employers to require union membership and dues as a condition of employment. Joining us now to talk about what impact that can have are Michael Kazin and James Chirk. Michael Kazin, history professor at Georgetown, co-editor of Dissent magazine, author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed the Nation. He joins us from his home in Chevy Chase in Maryland. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be here, Neil.
And James Shirk, a senior policy analyst in labor economics at the Heritage Foundation. He joins us from his studio there. Good to speak with you today.
Thank you.
And let me start with James Shirk. What difference does it make when this legislation passes?
Well, the main effect it has on workers is that for them, union dues becomes voluntary. They're not going to be forced to spend dues, which average between $600 and $900 a year, to give that to the union as a condition of teaching in a public school or as a condition of working in a factory, which is what the union contracts typically call for. Now, what that does is it has an effect, obviously, on union income, and union organizers become a lot less aggressive in right-to-work states. Union organizing attempts drop about 50% because if you can't force the workers to pay the dues, there's just less money on the table. And with less aggressive union organizers, a state becomes more attractive for businesses and investors. And you see an increase in manufacturing employment by about one-fifth to one-third is what the studies find. So it'll have an immediate effect on the workers, but it'll, in the long term, make Michigan a much more attractive place for business to locate and lead to more jobs being created.
Could you point to an example in a state with a right-to-work law where that's been operative?
Well, nationwide, right-to-work states have unemployment that's 0.7 of a percentage point lower than the unemployment rate in non-right-to-work states. But there was a really good study that was done about a decade or so ago, where there was a researcher who compared counties that bordered each other across a state line. So you've got the same workforce, the same regional economy, the same local economic conditions. The only thing that's different is one county was on the right-to-work side of a border and the other county was on the non-right-to-work side of the border. And he found that manufacturing employment was one-fifth to one-third higher in those counties that were on the right-to-work side than on the non-right-to-work side. And that's very strongly suggestive that the right-to-work law was the cause of that, because everything else, you've got the same population, the same regional cost.
I happened to read that study. He had some the author had some problems with his own methodology, but I get your point in general. Michael Kazin, let me ask you, what difference from your vantage point do right-to-work laws make?
Well, we can talk about studies, all day long and how good they are. One of the things that's pretty clear, I think, is that the states that have been right to work the longest are also very poor states, mostly in the Deep South, some in the Mountain West. And when unions are weak, which they almost always are when you have so-called right-to-work laws, because people can get something for nothing, and so they're not really there's no real reason for them to pay the dues, then you have a race to the bottom. Unemployment might be high, but wages are low, job security is not very good, the education system is not very good in those states. So, you have an acceleration of what's been happening in this country for the last 30 years as unions have gotten weaker. You've got an increasing wage gap, and corporations pretty much are able to do what they want. Makes sense that a corporation would move across the border from a non-right-to-work state to a right-to-work state, because obviously the wages are going to be lower.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Don's with us from Elkhart, Indiana.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
My comment had to do with the fact that Mitch Daniels, when he came into office, got rid of basically the state union ability. And I think overall the effect has been that public service is basically provided the same as it always has been. But Indiana is a very fiscally sound state. I'm a public employee, and I'm going to rely on public employee retirement funds that I know in Indiana are very, very solvent, as opposed to a place like Illinois, our neighbor, where if I worked there, I think I'd be very concerned that I would ever get, a dollar on a dollar on my retirement.
Just because the promises are far greater than their ability to pay out.
Exactly. So I think even though I'm not a member of a union and I work for, the public service here in Elkhart, and I did work for the state for a while, the trade-off to me has been that I'm just confident that I'm going to have employment. I'm not making a ton of money, but when I retire, I think the money's going to be there.
All right, Don. Thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
And let's see if we go next to this is Frank, and Frank's on the line with us from Tulsa.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Frank.
Oklahoma passed right to work 10 years ago, and we've not seen the changes that those who promised right to work, like the gentleman from the Heritage Foundation said would be. Wages are stagnant, workplace conditions are worse than ever, businesses and corporations are more emboldened to treat employees unfairly, and wages have declined. Wages in Oklahoma have declined since right to work. It's not been the be-all and end-all that has been promised.
And what business do you work in?
I'm an attorney that represents labor unions.
And has their membership gone down?
Their membership has gone down some, not greatly, not like those who supported it and were behind it had hoped. There has been a net loss in members, though.
James Shirk, thank you very much for the call, Frank. Appreciate it. James Shirk, I wanted to ask you, I'm not familiar with the numbers in Oklahoma. That state, of course, has benefited tremendously from its oil business in recent years, and there's a lot of construction in the state of Oklahoma as well. Is our caller correct?
Well, again, you've got to take a look at what's going on to manufacturing nationwide. In the past decade, manufacturing in right-to-work state and in non-right-to-work states has fallen. It's fallen faster in the non-right-to-work states. Manufacturing employment dropped by about 3% a year in the non-right-to-work states versus only about 1.7% a year in the right-to-work states. And so it's certainly it's not a be-all, end-all. You know, certainly there's, you know, there's broader global and technological issues that are affecting manufacturing, and I certainly who would argue that it's, you know, it's a solution to all of the state's economic problems? But does it help? Yes. Does it attract investment? Yes. We have seen an increase in foreign investment into Oklahoma, and I think they're better off today than they would have been had they not passed it.
Michael Kazin, as you listen to those callers with very different concerns, certainly the problem with public employee pensions is not limited to Illinois, as our caller said, and Indiana, though, is one of the very few states that seems solvent.
That's probably true, but of course, a lot of this depends on the taxation in a given state. There's a lot more corruption in Illinois, I believe, as well. I don't think that has much to do with unions or the lack of union strength. You know, I don't know enough about the comparative economies of Illinois and Indiana to make a comment on that. But I do want to say that I think, you know, the reason why unions and people who support unions the way I do think that right to work is the wrong idea is because it's what sociologists call the free rider problem. That is, there's no requirement in any state, including non-right to work states, that anybody join a union. The only requirement, and Mr. Shirk knows this very well, is that. It's called agency rights. That is, if a union has a contract in a given workplace, then you have to pay union fees. You have to pay you've got to pay in to the institution which has won those benefits for you, and that just seems pure justice, you know, to a lot of people, I think, and obviously to the people who are demonstrating today in Lansing.
People getting the benefit of the union's bargaining without having to pay
exactly.
To support the union.
I mean, in some ways, it's like Social Security. I mean, we have to pay payroll tax if you want to get Social Security in the end. And most of us are quite happy to get Social Security. But if you said, well, you can get Social Security, but you can decide for yourself, you have the freedom to decide whether to pay that payroll tax or not, I think we'd say that was a little bit crazy.
James Shirk?
The problem is that union contracts benefit some workers at the expense of others. Consider a high-performing worker. Well, a seniority system is actually holding him back. He could get a raise faster than what the unions negotiated for him, or seniority-based layoffs, where the new hires are going to be first on the chopping block to get laid off. They don't benefit from the union contract, but the union is insisting that, you know, they pay for it anyway. I mean, unions could. The Supreme Court has recognized repeatedly the right of unions to negotiate members-only contracts that only cover their members. So they could say, all right, we'll negotiate for our members. You guys do your own thing. They don't do that. They voluntarily choose to represent everyone in the workforce precisely because they want those new hires to be forced into the seniority system so they get laid off first and the more senior union members don't get laid off. And the law gives them that power. But they shouldn't be able to force all the workers in the company to pay dues to the union simply to work. I mean, it's, you know, it's your money. You've worked to earn it. If you're a worker, you shouldn't be forced to pay the union simply to hold a job.
Let's get another caller in. This is Grace, another caller from Tulsa.
Yes, ma'am, sir. I was having an example of American Airlines here in Tulsa, which is the largest employer here in Tulsa. And, you know, my father-in-law, he retired when he was 59, when it was a very, very solvent company. And all of our Tulsa community thrived. And those people, you know, huge communities grew. Well, now we have stagnant wages. American Airlines has given up their benefits over the last 10 years. The unions have different segments of it. $5-$7 an hour they've given up. Health benefits they've given back up. Pension plans they've lowered. And still the American Airlines people are going broke. So I just think that it's really a fallacy that business is going to do better, you know, if we don't have unions. I mean, unions have given all of us great benefits, as far as people that aren't even in a union. We wouldn't have a vacation. We wouldn't have, you know, safety on the job, lots of those things. And I do not here in Oklahoma see anything improving.
Michael Kazin, going back to things like the 40-hour work week and vacations, that sort of thing, that's what part of what your book is about.
Yeah, we have a Labor Day holiday because of unions as well, so people can barbecue on a nice day in early September.
Unless you work at a mall.
Well, of course, yeah. And that's, of course, most people who work at malls aren't in unions. But, you know, I think the difference between me and Mr. Shirk, and it's an important difference, is a question of a definition of freedom in many ways. I mean, Mr. Shirk, like most conservatives, believes that the most important definition of freedom is the individual should do whatever he or she wants at any given time as much as possible. And I respect that definition, but the reason unions exist is because of a different idea of solidarity, of everyone sort of helping everyone else. And in fact, if you had some workers who were in the union and paid dues, other workers in the same workplace, same working side by side with one another who are not in the union, some making a lot more money than others, you know, it's not a good workplace environment. And as I said, you know, the idea of that unions began with was to protect, to give it, to be a countervailing power to corporations. I mean, what Mr. Shirk is saying, in effect, is that corporations have all the freedom they want to hire and fire. If there's a 22-year-old who's doing a better job than a 40-year-old, then that 40-year-old can be fired. And union contracts exist to make sure that kind of thing can't happen.
Grace, thanks very much for the call.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And James Shirk, I wanted to ask you, was that a fair characterization?
Well, to some extent what he's saying. I mean, there is certainly a very different conception of freedom between those on the left and those on the right. Certainly those on the left tend to take a more collective view, and those on the right tend to be more focused on the individual. But I think you take a look at some of these union contracts, and they're very often not focused on the collective good. I mean, you take a look at public education. You've got these last hired, first fired seniority provisions. And so you have like the Milwaukee Public Schools in 2010 awarded Megan Sampson their Outstanding First-Year Teacher Award, and then a week later fired her. Why? Because she didn't have seniority. Well, was that in the best interest of the children? No, I don't think it was. But she was fired because that was the union contract, that they wanted the new hires to go first. Mm-hmm. And I think it leads to tremendous unfairness for individual workers who the collective has decided you're going to take the hit for us.
Let me ask you another question, and I want to hear from Michael Kazin, too. Is this about economics or is it about politics? You look at the states that are right-to-work states. It looks a little like the map of the George W. Bush last election in 2004.
Well, I think it's about both economics and the different conception of freedom, he said. Again, you're going to get more conservative states are going to be more sympathetic to the argument for right to work, that you shouldn't be forced to pay union dues in order to work or in order to teach. But at the same time, it's also about economics. Why is Michigan taking this up now? Why is Indiana taking it up now? Well, you know, you had Republican majorities in the 2000s, you know, a decade ago in those states, and you didn't touch it then. Why now? I think it's because the recession's been so bad that they want to do what they can to attract jobs and encourage economic development in their states, whereas that wasn't quite as pressing in the past.
Michael Kazin, is it about economics or is it about politics?
Well, it's both, obviously. It usually is. I mean, if right to work was so great for the economy, then why the golden age of American capitalism was 1950s and 1960s when we had the highest percentage of private sector workers and unions we ever have had before or since in American history. There are many reasons for that. But one reason is because unions help to level the playing field much more. But also politically, I mean, one of the interesting things about this Michigan law is that it exempts firefighters and police. And why is that? Well, you can argue different things, but one of the reasons, I think, is that firefighters and police have a tradition in Michigan of supporting Republicans.
I would just add that in the Michigan State Constitution, they have collective bargaining for the public safety workers directly in the state constitution. So it's something the legislature just had no authority to change. That they consulted their lawyers and were told that it wouldn't pass muster under the state constitution. So they didn't have much of a choice there.
Well, we'll leave it there. And James Shirk, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
James Shirk is a senior policy analyst in labor economics at the Heritage Foundation and joined us from the studio there. Michael Kazin, professor of history at Georgetown University, co-editor of Dissent magazine, author of American Dreamers, How the Left Changed a Nation, with us by phone today from his home in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Neil.
Up next, gay marriage. The Supreme Court has decided to hear two major cases on it for the first time in 2013. Our next guest, who supports gay marriage, worries it may be too soon for his cause. Jonathan Capehart will join us after a short break. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.